Volatility, uncertainty, complexity. This is the work environment that is our reality. What will leaders need to know to be successful in the future? Who will they need to be to build team member commitment? How will they need to show up to create a motivating environment for their people? Welcome to the Sal Silvester on the Future of Leadership podcast, a dialogue about how leaders will need to adapt to be successful in a rapidly changing world. And now, please join your host and executive producer, Sal Silvester, to engage in the conversation about the future of leadership and how to transform people into confident leaders.
Hello and welcome to season 6 of Sal Silvester on the Future of Leadership. I'm Sal Silvester, your host and founder and CEO of 512 Solutions, an executive coaching and leadership development firm based here in Boulder, Colorado. Our mission, really simple: help organizations create healthy, aligned, and more human workplaces. As you may know, season 6 is all about creating healthy and aligned teams at the top, executive teams, senior leadership teams, extended leadership teams. And I'm thrilled to have Karen Eber on the show today. Karen is an expert on the topic of storytelling, and her forthcoming book, The Perfect Story, will be released in October 2023 by HarperCollins. So in this episode, Karen and I dive deep into the power of storytelling, including some super interesting information about what happens to the brain when people tell a story versus just sharing information. A bit about Karen: she's an author, international leadership consultant, professional storyteller, and keynote speaker. She's got a great TED talk on how the brain responds to stories and why it's crucial for leaders, over 2 million views. So check that out. As the CEO and chief storyteller of Eber Leadership Group, Karen helps Fortune 500 companies build leaders, teams, and culture one story at a time. She has a great background and experience. She works with companies like General Electric, Microsoft, Kraft, Facebook, Kate Spade, the big four consulting companies. She has guest lectured in universities, including the London School of Business, Stanford, and MIT. She contributes to publications like Fast Company. And with 20 years of experience, she's previously been head of culture, chief learning officer, and head of leadership development in General Electric and Deloitte. She's a four-time American training and development winner, and she lives in Atlanta, Georgia. This is a great episode. It's super practical, great tips on how to build connection and credibility as a leader. Let's go to the interview with Karen now. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to have you on, and I'm excited about this topic because it's certainly an area of improvement for me as a leader, and I think for so many leaders out there. So you have this forthcoming book, The Perfect Story. I'd love to hear from you, your perspective on why should leaders be telling stories to begin with?
In this age where people are turning to AI and ChatGPT and trying to find ways to cut corners, the thing that has the greatest connection with employees, with peers, with just humans is when you relate to one another, when you connect through a narrative. And by nature of telling a story, there's all sorts of things that happen neurologically that create empathy in the listener and lead to an increase in trust. And so if you want to build credibility, if you want people to follow you or believe in you, the nature of telling a story can make a big difference in this and extend your leadership. And so it's a skill that is just not only a foundational communication skill, it's a way to help inform, influence, and inspire people.
Yeah. We talk about connection a lot in our executive team development work and leadership development work that we do. And so it's interesting that this is one way to build connection and empathy with people. Why does it matter how you tell a story?
I love this question because the advice you hear all the time is tell a story, but we've all sat through enough terrible stories that the way you tell a story makes a difference. Otherwise, every story that you heard would be captivating and memorable and interesting, and it's just not true. there's certain ways your brain responds to the information that it's hearing, and stories in particular can engage and captivate a lot of it. And so the way you're doing that dictates how much of the brain you're engaging and how you're engaging it. And that's going to make a difference in how the person connects with the story and how it actually influences the outcome that you want.
I love the connection you're making to the brain. Can you talk more about the science of storytelling and like what happens in the brain when we listen to a story versus just listening to information that's being shared?
There's a whole slew of things, but I love to talk about what I call are the five factory settings of the brain, which is I look at neuroscience research of how the brain is going to respond to information versus communication. There are certain things that happen that are important to be aware of when you're communicating or telling a story, because the way you navigate or leverage them will impact them. So if it's okay, I'd love to go through the five.
Yeah, let's get into that.
Let's go.
Cool.
Sounds scary, sounds super sciencey, but it won't be, I promise.
Okay, so keep it understandable for people like me.
Totally. The first one to illustrate that is your brain is lazy. So it's a little weird to hear because it is probably our most important organ that keeps us alive. It uses 20% of the body's calories, the most of any organ. And because of that, the number one goal of the brain is get you through the day alive, which means it wants you to do things the exact same way you did yesterday because it worked. You lived, do it again, same way. And it wants to always have this surplus of calories. The moment your brain bankrupts itself of calories, that's a problem. You're not alive. So it's always looking for where can it zone out? Where can it take a break? And this is why when your brain drifts off in a meeting or a conversation, it doesn't mean that you're a terrible listener. It just means that this is a natural part of our brains have to find these moments to conserve calories and take a break. And so this is why you come home at night from a hard day and you put on that show you've seen so many times before, because you think like, I don't want to think. I just want to sit and relax. And that's important in storytelling, because if you're not telling a story that has interesting or unexpected details or even engages the senses, the brain is going to choose that moment to just kind of drift off, which is what it does when we hear these really boring stories. So what you want to be thoughtful of is how are you putting things in your story that makes the brain spend calories?
So that's the first one. It's like a survival function
completely
of the brain. Okay. And now you've also explained why I've seen the movie Patton like 30 times, maybe.
We all have our comfort stuff, and it is a combination of you get a dopamine hit for whatever that is for you, but it's also like it's easy and your brain gets to take a break. And so that when you start to recognize that and find those moments, that's when you realize, oh, okay, I'm just needing a little downtime.
Right. Okay. Awesome. So that's the first of five.
That is the first
one. Our brains are lazy. What's next?
The second is paired with that first one. It's that our brains love to make assumptions. So let me tell you, when I was in university, I was locked in the library on a Friday night. What does that bring to mind for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess what it brings to mind is maybe you were hooking up with someone. I don't know.
That's not what I've gotten.
Not what you expected.
No, I wasn't expecting that. So what I love about this is if there were five people here and we asked each of the five, you're saying hooking up. Someone else would say you were cramming for an exam. Someone else would say, how did you eat? Like everyone would have a different idea. And it's because we all make these assumptions. So part of the calorie saving and spending is that our brains are futurists and we want to make predictions and not reactions. We want to be able to predict not only what's happening in our environment and how do we stay safe, but we want to predict how do I need to extend my arm? How do I need to set my foot on the floor to be able to stand up and walk? So our brain is using 80% of those calories to make these predictions, because when you predict, you're able to save more calories. When you react, you have to spend more than you want. And so part of predicting is we're going to make assumptions for what we're hearing, for what we're seeing, for what we take in.
Yeah.
So you hear this little snippet about me. I give you one sentence and you finish this story in your head without even really a lot of prompting, which is what everyone does, which is why in particular, when you tell stories with data, never speaks for itself, because we are all putting our own Rorschach tests in place. We're looking at the ink blot and making assumptions for what's there in the data.
Yeah.
So when you're telling a story, you either want to slow down these assumptions by putting in things that are unexpected, sequencing it in a way that's hard to know what's going to happen, or you want to lean into those assumptions. So if I said to you, he gave her the passcode to his phone, what does that make you think?
Trust.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I might say that to show you versus tell you and lean into this idea of trust. Mm-hmm. So two of the five help you start to see, oh, I get why the different elements in the story and the way they're placed in the story can make it different.
Awesome. That's very cool. I can also see, I did a podcast last year with Dr. Amy Tolbert on unconscious bias. And you could also see where those assumptions lead to unconscious bias that may happen at work. I know that's not really the topic 100%. For today, but it's still that neuroscience that we 100%. Have to think about as leaders. Yeah.
And that's actually related to the third factory setting, which is that we have this library of files in our brain. So when I gave you that sentence about the library, you immediately went to, I was hooking up with someone.
Oh, no.
And this that's is gonna based come back on and haunt whatever, me. By the way, it's based on whatever your knowledge and experiences were. So perhaps you had your own library interlude, but every person is going to do that differently. And this is where unconscious bias comes in. We're filtering information in through our own experiences. So if you take a photo on your phone, on your camera, it immediately gets stamped with the date, the location, the f-stop, the size of the file, like all of this information is stored on it without you doing anything. Something similar happens when we take in information through our senses that gets stamped with emotion. And then it gets stored into our long-term memory. And that is what is called upon when our brain goes to make predictions. It goes into that library of files and looks at what have we experienced before and what can we use to infer here. And so that is the root of bias, but it is also where we are making our own interpretations. So what that means in a story is you want to anchor to what people know. You want to leverage that. So if I said to you, he had a small scar, small could probably vary anywhere from a few millimeters to a few inches. But if I say to you, the scar is the size of a paperclip, you immediately get the image of what size that is. And it's placed in your brain. The cognitive load is removed. You don't even have to do any thinking. It's just an immediate understanding of what that is.
Yes.
So okay, when you're telling a story, you want to figure out like, where can you connect to what people know and put different things in? It could even be a time frame like 2 weeks before September 11th, 2001. Whatever that means to you, you're immediately going to think of in that moment. And so being able to connect to what people know is going to help remove cognitive load and make sure you get good understanding.
Interesting. My book editor used to say, show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's connecting here in that it was really about being descriptive, the paperclip size versus a small scar.
It is not just demonstrating, but it is actually cutting corners neurologically. So you get a very quick understanding, but it's also ensuring that your audience is understanding the same thing. So if I say to a room full of people, the scar's the size of a paperclip, everyone's going to get the same approximation of what that is. And so there's ways to do that, to work these different things in that are going to help with understanding, but also create just a stronger reaction. It lands differently as a point.
That makes
sense. So those first three work together in combination of the brain's lazy. It's going to be making these assumptions and predictions, and it's based on what you store in your library of files and the different details you put in and how you put them in make a difference in that.
Nice.
So that leaves the last two. The fourth one is that we naturally seek out in-groups or out-groups. So in-groups are people or groups that have similar values or interests or aspirations, or as I love to say to groups when we're at conferences, these are the people that when you walk in the room for the networking event, you're like looking for the person you're going to Velcro to your side for the next 2 days so you don't feel uncomfortable. In-groups are groups that just feel comfortable for us to be around. They feel safe and don't cause concern. And this is based on from our ancestry, the more people around, the more food, shelter, protection. Outgroups don't have to be negative though. Outgroups are just things that we feel different from. So charities use outgroups all the time when the Red Cross is sharing a story of a terrible natural disaster destroying someone's home. And you're watching this inside your home with air conditioning and water and food, and you're realizing how different your circumstances are. You're in an outgroup from them. Mm-hmm. And so when you're telling a story, you have this opportunity to think about, am I trying to create this feeling of an in-group where this is something the person knows or they aspire to, which is what sales does, or this is something that they feel different, that they don't feel a part of, which is something that charities do, but it's also something that an organizational change you do. Like, why can't we stay where we are? Why do we need to move forward? And sometimes you want to do both in a story, but it's thinking about what is that feeling you're trying to give the person listening.
Nice.
And then the last one builds on that a little bit, and it's really our neurological response that at the most simplest level, we seek pleasure and avoid pain. Mm. So we've got cortisol and adrenaline that are dumped in our body to increase focus when there's some threat or risk perceived. And what that's going to do is it's going to literally increase your focus and narrow your ability to pay attention to a whole bunch of things so that you can respond and make predictions. These are your avoid pain chemicals. Yes. And then we have the pleasure chemicals, which are serotonin, dopamine, oxytocin. These are released in response to connection and bonding and can't be manufactured. And they are the feel-good stories. And so you have the opportunity to think about, are you telling a story that is meant to make the person feel good? Or are you telling a story that maybe is meant to make the listener feel uncomfortable? Like, I opened my TED Talk with this story about a woman dropping her phone down an elevator shaft. That is intentionally meant to make you feel uncomfortable thinking about losing your phone. And so these five, you can start to see these different levers of how are you making the brain spend calories and how are you either leaning into assumptions or slowing them down? And what are you doing to connect to what people know? And are you trying to make them feel a part of something or different than something? And is it a feel good or uncomfortable or both? You can start to see now, depending on what you pull on, you start to make a much more dynamic story.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. That background is really helpful and it connects to so many other aspects of leadership. I'd love to dive into a bit about data-driven storytelling, because what we often see is an executive, a CFO, has to tell a story about what the numbers say and then what the business implications are to help shift thinking for the business or steer a company or a team in a certain direction. How do we make data stories meaningful and compelling?
First thing is to accept that you should tell a story with them. I find so many people say, I can't tell a story. I have to share data. And you are not going to connect to the data more just because it's data. You're really going to connect to the data because there is a story there. And using a story doesn't make the data manipulative. What it's doing is it's trying to create the same understanding. Mm. When we say data speaks for itself, it doesn't, because we know we're each going to be making our own assumptions and predictions. And based on our experiences, those are going to be very different. And so what you want to be able to achieve in telling a story with data is you want to take people through the story so they understand and are starting a conversation at the same common place, even if they don't agree. And so step one is recognizing how important that is. And the second thing is to really think about what is it that you want to do with the data before you have it in hand. So often it's a little bit like in middle school when you did your science experiment and you got the outcome and then you went back and wrote the scientific hypothesis that you were going to seek, which is fudging it quite a bit. That's kind of what happens with data. We get 50 slides and they're very detailed, or we have the Tableau graph and we start working backwards from there of, well, I could pull this one and this one, and almost like we're making this quilt of data, but it's not going to, what is it that, what's the question we're trying to answer? Mm. What are we looking for here? And so being really clear on what is the problem that you're trying to understand with the data, and what is it that you're seeing? Is it that you're looking to answer a question, or is there a pattern or an outlier in there? That makes a difference at the onset. And then from there, the most important step is to tell the smallest story you can tell. So I mentioned the Red Cross will tell the story of a family whose home was destroyed in a natural disaster. And they're standing outside the remnants of their home in tattered clothes with, you know, maybe a jug of water they just picked up off the truck. And you're hearing their story and you feel the weight of what's been lost for this family and what they have to figure out. And then they show you the size of the area impacted and the number of people impacted and the amount of time it's going to take to get them supplies and electricity and whatever. If they started with the size, it's too easy to lose the numbers. It's too easy not to connect with it. But when you connect to the smallest story and then you zoom out, you have a different understanding of it. And so what most often happens is people tell the largest story of data, but you want to start with the smallest story of data and then step back and zoom out, because then people have a different understanding of what it can mean.
Oh, interesting. So it was like the family that was impacted before zooming out to the overall town that was impacted or the environmental impact.
Right.
Yeah.
Think of any time you've heard of earthquake in a country where the first thing you hear is how many hundreds or thousands have died and you can't comprehend it. But then a reporter goes on the street and talks to someone individually and you see specifics and you hear from this person. And then the weight of that times whatever is almost overwhelming.
Yeah,
it's too easy with the large numbers not to connect with it. But yeah, when you can connect and understand with what it means for one and then extrapolate, it helps.
So for a business example, and this is coming top of mind just because a few clients have been through this, but let's say the numbers point to we have to do a reduction in force. What's the small story in that before the broader story that we might think about telling?
That's a little harder because I want to be careful around storytelling and manipulation, because this often comes up, right? When does it become manipulating? Yeah. And so it depends on the circumstance and we always treat it with care. But when it is a decision like a reduction in force or return to office or things like that,
return to office,
I feel like it's important to be direct with people. Mm-hmm. If you start telling a story in moments where the decision's already made and it's really more of a, we need to communicate this, it feels very manipulative. It feels like you're just spinning a narrative here and that doesn't feel authentic. And so when it's things like that, I don't advise telling stories because it does feel like people will sniff out that manipulation. But if it is something like there's a merger, there's an acquisition, and we want to talk about why we're doing that and what could happen, and there could potentially be some downsizing as a result of that, then I do think it's appropriate to think of a story there. And that story could go in so many different ways. That story could be about the employee. It could be about the customer. It could be about the value that's created. And there's really multiple stories, I'm sure, that would come out for something like that, because the goal of a story is always the audience you're talking to.
Right.
And so your idea would come from there. But I would be careful when it is something that is like a mandate is the word that's coming to mind, probably not the right word. It's best not to use a story because you'll feel manipulative.
Okay. Thank you. That is such a big help, because you're saying, look, there's times when we should tell stories and times when we shouldn't. Yeah. Are there other common mistakes? And then I want to maybe get into like how to tell a good story. But before we get there, are there other common mistakes or blind spots that leaders might make when either telling a story or using that story format?
Two come to mind. First is they don't tell stories. That's what I hear most often. Oh, right. I can't tell a story. Nobody invited me to tell a story. I don't have time to tell a story. It's just easier to present the data. So the thing to remember is while it might be easier to just open up and talk about data or open up and talk about your slides, that doesn't mean your audience is receiving it the way you think they are. We're not as effective as communicators as we think we are. And no one is really going to come to you and say, I really think you should tell a story here.
Right.
I'd like to hear a story from you. Stories are a compounding tool. So you tell a story, you get the opportunity to tell more stories. And you're not going to get an opportunity. No one's going to invite you to do it. You just need to do it. They don't have to be long. They can really make a difference in a short amount of time. So first mistake I see is that people just avoid it for fear. And there's vulnerability for sure.
Yes.
But get over that.
Right.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Because it is something that once you see the impact, it's really powerful. The second mistake is we love to tell the stories we want to tell and not the stories that the audience wants to hear.
Mm.
There was a CEO I was working with who really loved talking, very extroverted, not well organized in his thoughts. And he would just ramble and process and think that everyone was going to follow him and listen to everything that he said. And he just would tell story after story because he thought it was a great storyteller. He just was a lengthy talker. Mm-hmm. He was not a great storyteller. Yeah,
right.
And the problem was all the things he was saying never connected with his audience because a story starts with the audience, not with the idea.
Yeah.
Even if you know the story you want to tell, you have to start with your audience because there's something you want for them. Maybe it's an idea or a perspective, or maybe it's some action you want them to take or something you want them to feel. And that you have to get really clear on of what is it that you want them to get? What might be an obstacle to that? And use that as a starting point for your story, just like you would for your communication.
Yeah.
If you center on the story you want to tell, there's too good a chance that it will miss the mark for your audience. And mm-hmm. we've all sat at dinner tables with relatives where they just went on their script and they told the story they wanted to tell. And everyone was like, is he done yet?
Right. Yeah. When can we get up? Yeah, we often think in terms of do think. So what is it that you want your audience to do or think differently as a result of whatever you're trying to communicate?
And I'll add one more to that because sometimes it's something that the audience might not do or think, but you can use a story to change energy.
Oh,
so I just did a keynote for an International Mediators Association. So mediators by trade are meant to be impartial. They're there to guide a process and to try to mediate an outcome. So they're not telling a story to try to get one of the parties to decide one way, but they do need stories to inject energy, to create trust, to crack some oxygen into a discussion that might be going difficultly, which might not be something that the audience would know or do, but it does create this moment that is helpful. So I threw that in too.
Okay, that's awesome. So a couple of mistakes. One, which is just not telling stories. And then two is telling a story that you want to tell versus what the audience wants to hear. And it's a different perspective completely.
Yep. And I'll give you a third one, round it out with a nice odd number. Not leaving enough time.
Mm.
We spend so much time perfecting these PowerPoint presentations. We'll spend 2 hours tinkering with the alignment and the boxes and getting it just right. And then we spend 5 minutes thinking about what we're going to actually say.
Yeah.
That should be flipped.
Flip that.
If it's important enough for you to be communicating and sharing information and having an outcome, then you need to spend a little bit of time on it. And so the more you do storytelling, the more you can narrow the time spent. But it's not something that in 2 seconds you're going to tell the most amazing story. And I like to say there's a continuum, right? If you're giving a really big presentation, a TED type talk, you're going to be practicing that story quite a bit. It's going to take work and tinkering to get right. If you're giving an update in a meeting, you need more than 5 minutes, but you don't necessarily need 4 days to work on it. But what happens is most people focus more on the images or the slides or everything else, but what they're going to say. And if you can spend more time, leave yourself time to work on it, give the story a chance to breathe, it'll be more impactful.
Okay, that's really helpful. Maybe in the last 5 minutes here or so, Karen, we can get into what makes up a great story or how do you think about shaping a story? Do you have a framework or anything that we can really walk away with to create that next story?
I like to use a 4-part framework that can work in any setting. There's so many out there.
Right.
Use what works for you. What I find, though, is that things like The Hero's Journey or Pixar has an amazing model. But I find that in a business setting, people struggle with in The Hero's Journey, which is the basis for the Star Wars movies. Where does my guide on the side fit in? And how am I going to? And they get so stuck in the framework that they struggle to fit their idea. And so I like to use something that can fit any idea and you can play from there. And it has 4 parts. It is that a story has context, conflict, outcome, and a takeaway. And so when you are sitting down working on your story, you can build an outline for each of those with a sentence or two to help make sure you're getting the major pieces and tell a more focused story. So context is, what is the setting of the story? Who's involved? And why should the audience care? What's one or two sentences that summarizes that? The conflict is your fuel for the story. This is the gas pedal. When you run out of conflict, you run out of story. And so this is what happens that needs to be resolved. What is the tension? What is messy? This is the heart of the story. A sentence or two for that. The third is the outcome. So what's the result of the conflict? And then the takeaway is the part that most people miss, which is, what is the theme? If you were going to summarize the story up, like, what do you want the audience to take away? What's the result of this outcome and the overall theme of the story? And so in this time that you're preparing for a story, let's say you have 20 minutes before a meeting, you can write out a couple sentences for each of these, and already you're getting a better structure. Nice. It's not going to be a full story. You need to add in all the different things that we talked about at the beginning, but that gives you a structure to tell a more focused story, which makes it easier for the listener.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe one final question, and I might fit into this bucket. So what do you say to the person that says, look, I'm just not a good storyteller. I don't have any stories. Like, where do we find stories, or how do you help people think about where to get stories?
Love that. Let me ask you two questions and then I'll give you the answer.
Okay.
If I asked you to describe your childhood, what would you say?
I would probably describe like where I came from, East Coast, Italian Catholic family background. I'd probably talk a lot about my family, parents growing up with three younger brothers, and maybe think about some of my formative experiences, maybe a young Army officer or something like that.
Yeah. What I find is something very similar. Most people talk about the region or location, the number of siblings, the familial unit, like stuff like that, because it's such a broad question. Like, what do you mean? What file in my brain am I supposed to access? Right. Because you've just asked me about 18 plus years, it's too broad. So now if I ask you, what sound or smell reminds you of home, what comes to mind?
What sound or smell reminds me of home? It might be the humidity or something that you would feel on a warm and foggy day in Cape Cod, because that's where I spent all my summers, and it's now where my dad and two brothers live. And that's where we go when we go home.
Amazing. So now if we kept digging at that, there's probably 25 stories there easily, right? And also I'm feeling the humidity of Cape Cod as you see that. So the difference is we went from something too broad to something really narrow, which helped your brain say, oh, well, I can check these files. And I have this and I have this. And constraints introduce ideas. And the same thing happens for ideas for stories. When you think, I don't know what story to tell, it's because you need to put constraints in place.
Yeah.
You need to think about your professional experiences, or maybe a specific time in your professional career. Or maybe you need to think about the summers you spent on Cape Cod, think about things from your personal life. Or you could look at the types of things that your clients or customers talk about. Maybe you love art, or there's a podcast or something. So what you have to do is work through constraints, because the more constraints you put in place, the deeper you can dig. So your goal is to build a list of ideas agnostic of when you will use them. You want to build a toolkit of story ideas that you can call upon at any time to tell a story. Because when it is time to tell a story, the best time to gather ideas is when you don't need to tell one. And when it is time to tell one, you can scan the list and see which one of these will let me build this idea, build this takeaway. Okay. So constraints are your best friend in telling a story.
That's really helpful. All right, let me see if I can get some high-level summary points from our conversation. Number one, storytelling helps us maybe meet our deepest need as humans, which is to build connection with people. And as a result, leaders can be more credible. You laid out five factory settings around kind of the neuroscience and how our brain works. Brain's lazy. It likes to take breaks. It makes assumptions. It draws upon a library of files. It seeks out in-groups and out-groups. They're not necessarily good or bad, but we have to think about what we're trying to achieve during our story. And then it seeks pleasure and avoids pain. In terms of data, And in trying to take data and create a story from it, one, we have to recognize how important that is. We have to start small, but then zoom out as opposed to going really broad with the data at first. That was my big takeaway. Is that accurate,
yeah,
Karen?
Or, absolutely. Okay,
great. And then mistakes that leaders make, one, not telling stories. And then two, telling stories that they want to hear versus what their audience wants to hear and not leaving enough time to think about the stories. We spend a lot of time in those PowerPoints, but not enough time thinking about what we're going to say. You laid out a great four-part framework so that we can think about how to tell stories, the context, conflict, which is the fuel for the story, the outcome, the result that we're trying to create, and then the takeaway for our audience. And then as we're trying to think about what stories to tell, build out a toolkit of story ideas and start by constraint as opposed to going too broad so that we can go deeper in and dig deeper with some of those story ideas.
You got it. Awesome.
Awesome. Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining me today. And I'm so excited to get your book. I think it's coming out in September 2023. Is that accurate?
October, but right October. Around the corner. Yep. It's available for pre-order now everywhere books are sold.
Great. The Perfect Story with Karen Eber. Karen, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Sal Silvestro on the Future of Leadership podcast. You can get session notes on our website at 512solutions.com. That's the numbers 512solutions.com. Please follow and like the podcast on iTunes or wherever you're tuning in. And if you want to learn more about how we can help transform your people into confident and action-oriented leaders, please check out our website at 512solutions.com. I look forward to continuing the conversation about the future of leadership. I'm out.